Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Picamole Instruments is well on its way to developing a prototype for its new medical technology, thanks to Alberta Ingenuity and its industrial associateship program. And while calipers and paintbrushes may not be seen as weapons of mass destruction, when linked with social commentary, they can bring about societal change. Imagining Science is a collaboration between researchers and artists to give voice to social issues arising out of the new age of biotechnology. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. One of the unique programs that Alberta Ingenuity offers to the private sector is its Industrial Associateship Awards. These link companies in need of R&D with young scientists who can help them. Picamole Instruments, Inc. of Edmonton is a startup company with new technology that could greatly improve the way doctors diagnose disease. With funding from Alberta Ingenuity, Picamole Instruments has now hired Dr. Denis Dufour, a recent PhD graduate who will help the company refine and build its prototype.
Well, Picamole Instruments is a company that was founded 2 years ago by John Cormier, and the main focus of the company is developing the LifeSense instrument. LifeSense is an instrument that we're working on that is designed to measure hundreds of volatile organic compounds present either in human breath or in the atmosphere.
And how would you use that?
Well, our objective is to use the instrument in a clinical setting so that we can actually, by measuring the breath from people, it can actually give you an indication of what's happening inside that person. So it can be an indicator for various diseases or medical conditions.
Now, you're involved in this project through an Alberta Ingenuity Industrial Associateship grant. What is it that you're trying to do?
I'm working sort of on the nitty-gritty aspects of the instrument. So I'm actually, we're currently working on developing the prototype version. So I've been working on two things. One is the hardware development, so finding out which components we need and ordering them and getting everything assembled in the laboratory. So we can do comprehensive tests and work on improving the technology. And the other aspect of that is there's a lot of work that needs to be done on computer algorithms. One is to control all the various components of the instrument, and the other is to be able to, from the measurements, then figure out what's exactly in the sample that you're looking at.
What would be the challenges?
Well, it's challenging because it's a new type of technology and it's a new way of doing things that isn't really done. Normally, the way analysis techniques work for this type of technology is that you would kind of target one or two specific molecules, and we're kind of using a broader approach, kind of looking at the forest rather than the individual trees. And the hope is that using these algorithms and techniques that we've developed, that we can actually look simultaneously figure out what's going on, measuring, you know, 50 or hundreds of different compounds at the same time. And that gives you a more comprehensive feel for what's actually happening inside your body.
Well, what is the relationship of these VOCs to what's happening in your body? Does it mean that if you're sick, you exude horrible things?
Yeah, it kind of depends on the diseases you have. And in fact, it's a funny thing, about a year ago, I saw an article in the news where they were talking about dogs that are used for, they can actually smell cancer in people. So there's things that we exhale that are indicative of what's happening in our body, because the bloodstream is connected to the lungs, right? So anything that's happening in your lungs will actually get, the air will exchange between your lungs and the bloodstream. So you're going to get these compounds exhaled from you as you breathe out. So yeah, it can tell you a lot of different things about what's happening inside your body.
So your work then, looking at trying to find the right algorithms, how do you actually do that?
Well, it's a lot of statistics, and it's a lot of math involved, a lot of manipulating data, trying to do things like reduce the amount of noise in the signals, and basically it's just a lot of computation. And I have some experience doing this sort of thing from my PhD work, so I'm I'm applying this knowledge that I've acquired to this particular project.
When you say that there's a lot of statistics involved, how do you relate those statistics to the different compounds that you're trying to measure? How do you make those measurements?
Well, one thing that we're relying on is the database. So we have to know how each compound reacts to different frequencies of light. So there are databases available, and we basically use these databases in a mathematical model to try to figure out what is the most probable composition of the particular sample we're looking at.
Now, you say in your previous work, this has some sort of relationship. You've been working in the area of physics and atmospheric physics. How does this relate to your previous life then as a scientist?
Well, my previous work that I did my PhD on was atmospheric physics, but what I was working on were spectroscopic instruments, satellite instruments actually, that were looking at the ozone layer. And it's a very similar problem in a way, because what we were doing then was kind of looking at a whole atmosphere to figure out what the gases were in. Well, we're using a lot of the same techniques, except that instead of looking at a long path through the atmosphere, we're looking at a short path in an instrument that's we're going to be able to wheel around in a lab. So it's the same physical principles, but on a completely different scale.
How close are you to having that little instrument you can wheel around?
Well, that's probably still at least a year off. Right now, we're working on the sort of pre-laboratory test version. So we're trying to develop and push the technologies and test the different components. The challenge is miniaturizing it. Right now, we have an apparatus that is on a tabletop, and we're working on making it more rigid and more compact so that it can be put on a cart that you can wheel around.
Thank you very much, Denis.
Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Denis Dufour, Vice President of Technology Development for Picamole Instruments. He is the recipient of an Alberta Ingenuity Industrial Associateship. Cloning sheep or transferring the genes of fish into plants, these are just two examples of the advances in biotechnology or genomics. But where does this path ultimately lead? The public asks, if a company can patent life, what does this mean for humans and our rights as citizens of this planet? These questions lie at the heart of Dr. Timothy Caulfield's research. Tim holds a Canada Research Chair in Health Law and Policy at the University of Alberta. He's a director of the Health Law Institute, and he's project leader for a Genome Alberta program called GELS. GELS stands for Genetics, Ethics, Environment, Economy, Law, and Society.
I think one of the wonderful things that's happened is that a really interdisciplinary approach has emerged. So what we do is we look at basic legal issues like genetic discrimination, patent law. Some of these things sound kind of boring, but they're not. They're fascinating. You know, should you be able to patent human genetic material? Should you be able to patent stem cells? Should you be able to patent other kinds of biological entities? And you know, Canadians have really strong reactions to those ideas. And so we want to explore both sort of the legal aspect about that, technically, how should that play out? But we also want to get the perceptions of the public. So we work with people like Edna Einsiedel, who's a close colleague of mine at the University of Calgary, who runs focus groups. We do surveys. And we also look at how people like you, the media, handles these issues. How does the media respond to genetic stories, both good and bad? And what impact does that have on public perceptions and also policy? So we try to tackle the questions, the ethical, legal, social issues in a really broad manner, using both sort of conceptual, let's think about it approaches, but also empirical research. What are the actual problems? What are the actual issues? And try to bring that all together to ultimately make policy recommendations.
What is the debate then? What are you finding out through these focus groups, for example?
Well, there are so many issues in this area, and our project, we don't pretend to tackle all of them. I think it's fair to say we're looking at three broad areas, at least here at the Health Law Institute, and we have many other colleagues like Michelle Veeman here at the University of Alberta, who's doing more agricultural stuff, Peter Phillips at the University of Saskatchewan, who's looking at more economic issues. But here, the things that we're interested in are really, I think, three. One, the commercialization and patent issues, because that has real practical ramifications. You know, you need rightly or not, you need private funds to do a lot of this research. And that raises some unique issues around conflicts of interest, around public trust, and also on how it's going to impact the research environment when you have private funds available. So we're looking at those issues, and the public has real strong feelings about those things. You know, they really trust university researchers, but they not so much the private researchers. You know, they understand that there may be a profit motive involved, and that diminishes public trust somewhat. So how can you have the best of both worlds? How can you bring in those private funds that are necessary to do the research, but still maintain public trust, and more importantly, I think even perhaps more importantly, the integrity of the research itself. So we're looking at those kinds of issues. Another topic that we're exploring is how in a healthcare system like ours, where there are always resource issues involved, how are we going to make decisions about funding emerging genetic technologies? You know, this stuff ain't going to be cheap, and there's always all these other claims on the public purse. How are we going to decide what should we fund, what should be funded, and what should be integrated in the healthcare system, and how should we do that? And the other thing we're looking at, and it's a really fun topic, is the impact of popular representations of genetics. So not just the media, but also how the government represents it, how researchers themselves represent their work to the public. What's the nature of those public representations, and what impact is that having on public perceptions and how genetic technologies are being used? And it's a complex question. There's been, since the start of the Human Genome Project in, say, 1989, 1990, there's been this ongoing fear that we're geneticizing our healthcare, that we're overemphasizing genes and changing the perceptions of the general public. Well, is that true? Is one of the questions that we're trying to explore. And if it is, what's the impact? So that's why we're studying things like the media, and we're studying public perception. So it's really exciting, fun work that is going to be going on for some time.
Well, you mentioned the media, and certainly one of the things that you look at is public fear. Mm-hmm. Where did the media fit in with either allaying or fueling public fears about what's happening with the genomics? I'm just thinking of the transgenic corn scare of a few years ago.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, because what we have found, and I think other researchers around the world have found, is that, and this is no surprise to someone working in the media, generally you get two stories. One, it's the breakthrough story. It's the next great innovation. It's going to save lives in the near future. So you have the breakthrough story, and then you have the disaster story, right? And often that moderate middle ground is lost. And it's understandable why that happens. There are many social forces at play that create that polarization, right? There's the commercialization aspect that I talked about before that is driving the need to categorize or to frame research as exciting and potentially commercializable and having a near future impact. But also there's this pressure to sell newspapers and make this interesting and digestible. So you have these kind of the fear. And there's other agendas at play also, for sure, that may cause some of the risks to be overemphasized. Not always, but often. So we have found that you have this polarization happening in the media, but not just in the media. Often you see that in policy reports, etc. So there is some evidence that kind of polarization, those kind of portrayals, that does have an impact on public perception, not surprisingly, because the public gets so much of their information from the media. There's evidence that shows that once you leave, you know, university or high school, almost all your information about science comes from the media. But it's complex, because it's not some kind of linear, straightforward, the public just takes whatever the media is told to them. It's a very complex relationship. The public views all the information that comes from the media through their own values, through their own beliefs, and incorporates that information accordingly. So it's a really complex story. Having said that, there seems no doubt that the media plays an important role in shaping public perceptions, and also perhaps one of our recent studies shows that it may also influence policy development. It's by setting the agenda, right? By saying this stuff is important, it's in the media all the time, so policymakers, you better act on it.
This is pretty complex, complicated stuff. It's based in science and then trying to communicate. And for most of us, we're simply scientifically illiterate to begin with. How do you overcome that?
That illiteracy problem is fascinating, because there's two aspects to it. One, there's an old idea that's called the deficit model, which has been largely, I think, no one takes it seriously anymore. And the idea here is that if we could just teach the the public about how great science is, and if they just knew more, they wouldn't be resistant to it. Well, that's not really true. Unfortunately, it's much more complicated than that, because even if people learn about science, and stem cell research is a really good example of this, they may have other reasons why they object. I mean, we shouldn't view public engagement as an exercise in bringing the public on side. It has to be meaningful. It has to be real. And we need to respect how the public actually feels. So it has to be a public engagement where we're really trying to get a sense of how the public feels about these things. And given that, whatever that the answer may be, how should we respond? So if you look like something like stem cell research, there is a sector of society, no matter how much you taught them, no matter how much they learned about stem cell research, they probably still will have strong moral objections to it. It's a small sector in Canada, but still that's a sector that needs to be respected and heard.
Well, you've got an interesting project on the go now, and it's with your brother, Sean. Mm-hmm. And it deals with art and science and genomics. Yeah. What's this all about?
Yeah, this is a great project, and I must admit I'm a little conflicted because part of the excuse was just to have the opportunity to work with my brother, who's a fine arts professor here on campus. And we've never had a project together, but we've had lots of the same interests. He loves interdisciplinary research also. So we thought we'd do a project together. And what we're doing is bringing together world-renowned, what we call social commentators, so law professors, philosophers, economists, really world-renowned from all over, world-renowned scientists and world-renowned artists, bringing them together. We're going to meet in Banff this week, and we're going to discuss our work, hopefully inspiring each other. And then the idea is that we're going to, from that meeting, we're going to produce original artwork. The artists are going to produce original artwork. We're going to create essays that deal with the social ethical issues around emerging science, the controversies. And then we're going to create a book. They'll have both of them. And also we'll have a show at the Alberta Art Gallery, who've been very supportive, next year. So it's a really exciting project. And here what we want to do is we're hoping it's going to work on two levels. One, a very rich, genuine exploration of the social issues through the lens of art that will be informed by very thoughtful social commentators, but also as a medium to engage the public. You know, I think art can work on both those levels. So we're hoping it's both fun, exciting, but also a very serious academic exercise.
Thank you very much, Tim.
That was a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Dr. Timothy Caulfield, project leader of GELS with Genome Alberta. He also holds a Canada Research Chair in Health Law and Policy, and he's director of the Health Law Institute at the University of Alberta. On the surface, science and art present different views of the world, one mechanistic, the other a storm of emotion. This weekend at the Banff Center, the two worlds collide in a workshop hosted by two brothers who themselves represent the yin and yang of human life. Dr. Tim Caulfield, as we heard, is a law professor. His brother is Dr. Sean Caulfield, an artist who holds a Canada Research Chair in Printmaking at the University of Alberta. The workshop is called Imagining Science, and it's the first stage in bringing together scientists, artists, and philosophers to comment on what the new age of biotechnology means for society. I asked Sean if there was common ground to be found between science and art.
That's a very good point, and I think the first thing I'll say is maybe they're not as different as people think, and I mean, there's a highly creative element in science, right, and a highly intuitive side, I think, to science that people sometimes forget. So I'll just make that sort of broad statement first. But to answer your question, maybe I would use an analogy and look back to another period where there was a dramatic shift in science, and I'm thinking of the atomic age, which is still having a huge impact on us. There was a lot of artists that responded to that. And whether it was artists who were making paintings that were very political, maybe about Hiroshima, or other artists that were working maybe abstractly and were trying to talk about the anxiety that people felt in response to this new horrible and wonderful technology. So that's, I think, an interesting analogy. And where I'm going with that is I think when you think about something like the atomic bomb, you can understand it in terms of the science. You can talk about it in terms of science. You can talk about it in terms of history. You know, why did that happen? What are the political forces, etc.? But there's another side to that that I think only art can talk to. The horror of it, the wonder of it, that I think you need a very specific kind of language to talk about. So that's, I think, where the dialogue comes in. And so rather than seeing science and art as separate, as very different, I'd rather see it as a continuum where we're all pursuing knowledge, but with different voices and with different kinds of language.
That was the atomic age.
Yeah.
Now we're into the genomic age.
Yes.
So how do you, as an artist, how are you thinking about the age of the gene, the age of genomics?
Yeah, again, a great question. And as I said, I think the group of artists that are coming, some have already sort of dived into this pretty heavily. And then there's some artists like myself and others that are coming that are just have been thinking about this issue and aren't as involved as others. So the first thing I'd say is I'm partly looking to this workshop to learn. As an opportunity to reflect, to think back, and then how can I really engage my studio practice? Having said that, up to this point, some things that have interested me about this question of genes and research associated with biotechnology is the way we think about our bodies differently, maybe. I'm an artist who often looks back to art history as a kind of motivational tool, and as I was preparing for this workshop, actually, I started to look at some historic slides of various people. And one person I came across was William Blake. And you probably know the work. It's William Blake's Illustrations of Milton's Paradise Lost. And here we are in the 1600s. And we have, you know, you'd think it's about religion. It's not related to science at all. But if you read the text, Milton makes a fairly explicit reference to science. And it's about human arrogance, you know, that human beings shouldn't meddle with natural law, with God's law. And the result of that, of course, is punishment, right? But where I'm kind of going with that is what I was interested in that image is the poetics around what happened because of that punishment. There was a lot of human figures that were transformed, that were merged with other creatures, that were, it's a very visceral, violent poem. So all of that initially, it doesn't seem like it could directly relate to, say, science and genetics, but it seems to be about our fear, our anxiety about what happens when we meddle in areas that we shouldn't meddle. And I think that's the sort of language I'm interested in exploring right now, language that is maybe about the body, that is about the anxiety we might feel about the way the world is changing and the way maybe we shouldn't be meddling with things.
Well, do you think fear is the overriding factor?
Good point. No, I don't. I think there is a lot of fear. I'm getting started on this project. I know a few of the science side people have made the comment that they're disappointed with artists because it's always negative. I don't think that's entirely true. I think there are some artists trying to be more positive. But I think there is a lot of skepticism and a lot of negative feeling, not just among artists, but among the public in general.
Artists tend to be a rather dark lot, though.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. And I guess I was making that, I brought up the William Blake example, partly as to demonstrate a historic precedent. Part of the negative stuff might be that there's been a long history of people worried about us meddling with God's laws, right? And so there's a lot of negative history there. That's probably partly influencing why a lot of it is negative. Having said all that, though, some of the artists that are coming are sort of more positive, if you will.
Now, one of the issues central to all of this is dealing with public perception.
Mm-hmm.
So if the public is already having a bit of a hard time dealing with what's coming in the future from science mm-hmm. and technology, mm-hmm. and a lot of people really do have a hard time getting art.
Yes.
What does that red streak on the wall mean?
Yeah.
Those sorts of things. How are you then going to deal with, communicating with the public what it is that is going on in the artist's mind, that's going on in the scientist's mind, and trying to deal with the social commentary?
Mm-hmm. Great question. And I think, I guess to my mind, there's not one answer there. To begin to answer that question, I guess I would say what I'm hoping to do in my work and what I think these other artists are hoping to do is to get beyond the negative, the positive, simple answers. I think what they're all trying to do is say, look, this is complex. And so on one level, I don't think any of them want to simplify their work in order to make it more digestible or easy to comprehend. I think there's this notion that this is complex. We're not going to pretend it's not. What we're going to try to do is to help you sort it out together. This isn't about us telling you, oh, you know, feel this way or that way. So that's, I guess, one statement I make. The other side of that is then, I think, the challenge of getting it out there. So I think art production, even science research production, is always multifaceted. There's doing it, and then there's disseminating it, right? And doing both is always a challenge. So I guess part of the notion behind this project is the getting it out there part. It makes these issues more public. It's going to happen at the Art Gallery of Alberta, very public, you know, public institution. We have the opportunity to do this kind of thing, interviews. So I see it as a twofold thing. Just make the work, respond honestly, talk about the complexity of the problems, and then work hard to disseminate it. And that's the other side of this project.
Thank you very much, Sean.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Sean Caulfield, who holds a Canada Research Chair in Printmaking at the University of Alberta. He and his brother, law professor Dr. Timothy Caulfield, are the creative force behind Imagining Science, an artistic exploration of science, society, and social change. Sponsored by Genome Alberta, an exhibit will be held at the Alberta Art Gallery in November 2008. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our e-newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by Genome Alberta, Alberta Ingenuity, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, the Alberta Conservation Association, the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, the University of Lethbridge, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Research Council, and the NSERC Industrial Chair in Integrated Landscape Management. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.